2 years ago, I started reading Boundless Parenting shortly after hearing the heartbeat of what I now think of as my first son. But we lost him in the sixth month due to a random cord incident. For a while, I said, we lost the pregnancy, instead of, I lost a child. Maybe because I never saw his face. I stopped reading it, but nearly 9 months ago, I picked it back up again, after discovering that we had another one on the way. Becoming a new father is a page flip without equal to a really new chapter of life, and I have a lot to learn. So finishing a nearly 1,000-page book on the topic seems smart. I'm Jonathan with Limitless Mindset, and below wherever you're watching or listening to me, you'll find a link that is going to have, well, it's going to have everything that I might mention here. Yeah, if I give you a link rabbit hole, that's going to be through that link. So do check that out. And I suppose this is the first of a lot of parenting content that you can expect from me. But those who have followed me for a while know that I didn't start offering marriage advice until after I'd remained happily married for at least half a decade. Similarly, as long as I lack experience in the parenting department, I'll try to keep my content around the topic grounded in the authoritative experiences of others or sound scientific research. And I've got a story to begin with. We'll call it The Elasticity of the Protective Impulse at the Playground. Lately, I've been doing light workouts a few times a week at this park near my flat in Sofia that has one of those basic free weatherproof gyms next to the playground where you can do an assortment of body weight exercises. And there are almost always kids and young people there. One thing that makes me confident about raising a family here in Bulgaria is that the culture is relatively healthy here. Like the other day, I saw 4 young dudes. They looked like teenagers, and they were there working out. And get this, none of them had smartphones. They were just 4 teenagers hanging out outside, making some jokes, doing a little bit of roughhousing, exercising. I freaking love to see teenagers who are outside and not on the computer. Yeah, that's why I love Bulgaria. And the other day there, this little girl climbed up on the monkey bars where someone had hung a rubber exercise band. And basically, she wanted to put one foot in the exercise band and then bounce up and down, hanging from the monkey bars, which I'm sure is fun. But she was small enough that she could slip and fall off the monkey bars with one foot in the band and hurt herself. Her mother or grandmother was sitting a ways away and didn't really seem to be paying attention. And I really don't want to touch some random little girl, helping her step into a band so that she can bounce up and down on the playground. So I just told her in Bulgarian, this is dangerous. Tova e opasno. And I let her do whatever she wanted. I got back to my workout. Later, I reflected on this and I said to myself, That was kind of a proto-parenting moment, wasn't it? I had this protective impulse when I saw a kid doing something kind of dangerous, so I had to intervene. But ultimately, all I could do was tell her, this is dangerous. I figured if she fell and hurt herself, then she'll remember that some random adult warned her first. And if she managed to balance on the bouncy exercise band, then she gets the confidence boost that she managed to navigate doing something dangerous. Which is, that's probably a good thing, right? And I suspect that I've got about 2 decades of situations with exactly that same dilemma in them ahead of me. An important point on the economics of information consumption. So this book is $55 in hardcover and $20 on Kindle. Some of you may be shaking your heads at the fact that digital books, which are a frickin' file, that all Amazon does is deliver a file from their servers to your device. Some of you may be shaking your heads at the fact that they cost that much these days. And perhaps you're thinking, I'll just listen to Ben Greenfield's podcast about parenting, because podcasts are free. Well, only if your time is next to worthless. When your favorite podcasters put out books, it actually makes a lot of sense to buy and read those books, even if you can get that information for free from their shows, because books are guaranteed a refined distillation of their knowledge, which you care about their knowledge, because, well, obviously you do. Otherwise, you wouldn't listen to their show. So yeah, buying your favorite podcaster's books is a good idea, especially if said podcasters insert an insane amount of audience time-wasting mid-roll ads into their podcasts, like Ben Greenfield does. By the way, my podcast, which you're listening to, no audience time-wasting ads inserted, and I do have a couple of books that you can pick up. So Boundless Parenting is written not just by Ben Greenfield, but also by 37 parents ranging from single divorcees to grandparents, to celebrities, to entrepreneurs, to pastors, to teachers, to survivalists, and beyond. In each chapter, Ben Greenfield interviews a unique parent or set of parents about the highly specific, practical, and personal details of their parenting journey, including the way they educate, discipline, manage time, develop presence, love, and ultimately raise amazing, self-actualized, and flourishing children. That's from the blurb of the book. And in this book review, I will try to give credit to them individually for the wisdom that I borrow from them here. I'll start with my biggest takeaway from the book, which is around the topic of family traditions. Ben Greenfield introduces this, quote, "Simplicity is okay. Consistency is a must. Dependency is fantastic. Presence is crucial. Weaving these memories into family tradition is more consequential than you may think." And he makes the case that family traditions are how you keep your kids interested in you, even once they start getting to that age where they have their own lives. He writes, "You made it so good that everybody wanted to stay. If you build your family upon the firm foundation of tradition, then you don't need to worry at all about old age abandonment, long distance, extended, tortuous separation from loved ones, or rarely seeing your kids again after they move out. Whether big or seemingly trivial, we get stability in our lives through traditions. And the cornerstone tradition is, of course, dinner time. And Joey and Barrett Coleman have two really fun dinner time ideas. First is quiz bowl. Several times per night, we have a quiz bowl where we go around the table and ask trivia questions. Second, best, worst, weirdest. Multiple times per week at dinner, we ask the boys a three-part question. What was the best part of your day? And you could also try playing cooperative board games. I've got some links to some of these, and they look really fun. I'm wondering where I can get these here in Bulgaria, where I live. And this was recommended by Paul Check. And he plays these with his children and his wives. He writes, with cooperative board games, you work together to achieve an objective. And it's great to see the kids working together. Hey, that is pretty cool. That sounds better than fighting over Monopoly, right? And yes, I said wives. This guy apparently has two wives, which I thought was illegal, but I guess he lives in California, so they let that sort of thing fly. And apparently he does make this work. I link to an excerpt of a podcast where he discusses what life is like with two wives. John and Missy Butcher describe dinner time trivia, a tradition started by Missy's dad that involves the adults crafting a variety of questions across multiple subjects and genres to quiz the kids and test their knowledge. Next, Isaac and Erica Jones describe and prescribe a family gratitude session, during which we ask the kids what they are grateful for that day. This forces them to focus daily on gratitude. At night, during dinner, we discuss the highlight of everyone's day or something that was challenging. Chris and Melissa Smith describe a Sunday family council. Quote, for our Sunday family council meetings, the whole family gathers to sit on the couch together and ask the following questions. What are you grateful for this week? What kind thing did a family member do for you this week? What's on your calendar this week? Does anyone have a challenge that they'd like some support with? Everyone has the opportunity to answer these questions, but no one is required to respond. Next, parents Tim Cochran and Janine Tidewell describe an ancestor supper. We've diligently worked to connect our children with their ancestry. We believe that the extent to which you know about your ancestors' suffering, as well as their victories and joy, is the same extent to which you are really living and grasping what it means to be alive. So we make a ritual for this by holding what we call ancestor supper. We consider this an educational endeavor, not just for ourselves, but for our children. We make the food and dishes our ancestors ate and labored to grow, forage, and hunt. Oh my gosh, that sounds so cool. And that has got me wondering about what are all the ancestral Bulgarian dishes. Also, hiking is hard to beat as a tradition. Rich and Gay Christensen, right? We have also found that hiking provides dedicated time with our children. And this is one of the reasons we love it so much. Going on weekend hikes gives us hundreds of hours on a mountain peak where we end up with each kid for an hour or two, alternating between deep conversations and heavy breathing. And I know that my wife is going to be paranoid about Lyme disease going hiking. So I'm going to have to look up what the Lyme disease prevention biohacks are. I'm thinking probably methylene blue. Oh, we'll see. We will find out. Next topic, scheduling. Ben writes at the beginning of the book, "By far, the most common thread appearing in nearly 70% of the parents' chapters is the practice of intentional calendaring or spending one-on-one time with each child in a family. I not only practice this strategy myself, but also calendar everything using the app BusyCal, which also syncs across all my devices and computers. Every single aspect of my life, including date nights, sex, meals, phone appointments, workouts, writing, naps, etc., is scheduled in a calendar that can be accessed at any time. And this has got me thinking, if it does not exist already, shortly there will be some kind of killer AI calendar application. There will be some sort of AI app that automatically monitors how you are spending all of your time and then puts it all into a calendar, giving you reports as to how you're spending your time, and then also like giving you recommendations of things like, hey, it's about time that you had a cuddle session without sex with your wife, right? Okay, another example of this. Todd Tripp writes, "I am a very scheduled person. I usually spend time with my kids individually at bedtime most evenings. I would usually read a story or psalm to them before bed. I would then try to get them talking and would just listen or ask questions. Pay attention not just to what was being said, but also to what was not being said. I would also ask non-judgmental questions to facilitate honest communication. One of my favorite phrases was, help me understand why. And now I'm thinking more about AI. I'm thinking I'm going to go out there and do some trialing and find the best AI for like calendar time management optimization. Because I've already got a really good app for time tracking. But as far as time spent optimization, I'm going to find an AI that can maybe help with that. And I will link to it in the show notes for this article. In the below, wherever you're watching or listening to me, you'll find that. Next, on the protective impulse, Ben writes, as my sons grew, I very quickly learned that it's good for a kid to not be excessively coddled or protected, to get a bit dirty, cut, or bruised when playing outside in the backyard, and to occasionally lick food off the kitchen floor. While I don't think I made a huge mistake when it came to overprotecting my children, I have learned a lot about setting aside worries of messing kids up and encouraging more childhood resilience, things I wish I had known earlier as a parent. However, Gary Greenfield, who is Ben Greenfield's dad, writes on ignoring his instincts and something really terrible that resulted. The biggest parenting decision I ever had to make involved my daughter Natalie when she was a teenager. At the time, we were living in a mansion that had been built in the 1890s and required restoration. It was an ambitious project for me. Consequently, I was always looking for people to help. At the same time, we were very involved with our local college community and would routinely invite students over for dinner or just to hang out in our living room. We were also housing several students. one of whom agreed to help with the renovation project in exchange for room and board. Shortly after this student moved into our home, I noticed that he and my daughter were becoming closer. So close that, as a father, I felt uncomfortable about it. I instructed both of them to treat one another as brother and sister, not as boyfriend and girlfriend. Despite my discomfort about this student living in our home, my wife and daughter kept convincing me to let him stay, in spite of the assurances of all parties involved. I would lie awake at night concerned about my daughter, sometimes even lingering in the hallway near her room, hoping to catch this student sneaking into her bedroom. This went on for over a year. I felt I was losing my mind as my wife and daughter continued to assure me that everything was fine. But in my heart, I knew something was amiss. Eventually, I put my foot down, listened to my intuition, and kicked him out. 2 years later, my daughter told me that she had been sexually assaulted by this student for the duration of his stay with us. The main takeaway from my experience was that it is very important to listen to my gut, to follow my intuition, and to do what I felt was right, even if other family members disagreed. And this story kind of blew my mind. It leaves a lot of questions open. Like, why didn't you have the kind of relationship with your daughter where she wouldn't go to you and tell you the very first time that she was sexually assaulted? Why did she let that go on for a whole year and then wait another 2 years to tell you about that? Yeah, there's a lot of questions there. And I think on this whole subject of like the protective impulse versus letting kids take risks so that they can learn resilience, I think as a parent myself, I'm going to be a bit of a sexist in this department and let the boys take risks and protect girls. Yeah, without thinking about it more, I think I'm going to go with the sexist direction on that. Next, on the screen time issue, it's described by Tim Cochran and Janine Tidewell. We all recognize the potential negative and addictive nature of screens on kids today, and we've taken a pretty non-traditional approach here. We don't have televisions in our home, and we significantly limit screen time. During the first 10 years of our lives, our sons had very little screen time. After that, we would allow them no more than 2 hours of screen time per week and always keep a connective family experience with at least one parent being present. Now that they are older, they get more screen time, but it's still quite limited. We do our best to monitor the content that they are consuming, recognizing this has a significant impact on their psyche and well-being. We don't allow screen time during the first hours of the morning or the last hours before bed. Several nights per week are screen-free. Everyone in the family puts their screens, including phones, away. As parents, we do our best to not use phones and screens when we are with our sons. We're always encouraging reading physical books, but Judy Arnall explains the upsides to screen time. I worried about issues around screen time while raising kids. But in retrospect, I know that kids move through developmental stages where they acquire self-control in normal, healthy families. In these situations, no matter how many hours of screen time a child has, they usually won't develop an addiction or problem with media. Alternatively, I have seen firsthand how kids can use screen time to further their careers, education, and connections with family and the world. There is great educational and interactive value in video gaming and posting an argument/debate on Reddit or other applications. And that is kind of a good point. When I think back on my adolescence, there was a couple of computer games I played that were really mind-expanding for me. I think about a computer game, there was like the SimCity computer games, and then there was a computer game where you would build and manage Roman cities. And boy, those taught me a whole lot about life. And then I played the Deus Ex computer game. And that computer game was like this amazing red pill at a time when culture was so, so blue pilled. That computer game was such a red pill. You learned about central banking from that computer game. You learned about things like how AI was gonna introduce this management layer on top of civilization. Yeah, those are the things you were learning in that game 2 decades ago. And so I think computer games in particular, and some tech, can be like a really awesome way to enrich a child's mind. The solution I think we're going to go with over here is using screen time as a bribe. So someone wrote, let's encourage mental health habits for them to earn screen time. Read daily to earn an extra hour a day of screen time. And the Christensens suggest something legalistic, but apparently pretty effective, which is write a contract stating that in order to get video game technology access, they'd have to agree to a set amount of playtime. We all signed it, and after that, we didn't have any problems. Kelly and Juliet Starrett actually made getting a smartphone a contractual issue with their teenage daughter, writing, we actually made her sign a social media contract, which was really more of an exercise meant to show her that we took it seriously and wanted her to understand the reality of being on social media. And Scott Donnell explains the importance of setting expectations. We also plan to set expectations when the kids eventually do get phones. They will surrender them before dinner each night. Yeah, there was a mother and son that we had dinner with a while back, and she was complaining that their 3 kids, they could not get their 3 kids to put the phones down at dinner times. That every single dinner, their 3 kids, all 3 just sat there on their phones the entire dinner and had very little interaction with the rest of them. And I said, that is ridiculous. You should have set expectations and made rules before you brought them those phones. Next topic, discipline. Discipline is for defiance. Todd Tripp explains, I also would have liked to have had more insight into the differences between correction and discipline. Children do many things that require correction. Discipline must be saved for defiant behavior. For example, our 3-year-old pushes over his 18-month-old sister and grabs her toy. As a parent, This is obviously upsetting to see. She is left crying while he has selfishly taken her toy. But I am not going to discipline him for this. Instead, I'm going to correct him. His behavior is not defiant toward parental authority. It is the impulsive action of a three-year-old. He sees something he wants and goes for it. I'm going to correct him like this. No, 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 no. You cannot take your sister's toy. She was playing with that. It is wrong for you to take it from her. You must give it back. Since children learn concepts and ideas by hearing them used appropriately in context, I'm going to use the language of the heart in correcting him with phrases such as, you're not being kind to your sister. You are not loving her. You are loving you. You are not serving her. You are serving yourself. This conversation communicates that my concern deals with more than just his action of taking the toy. I'm concerned about the indifference that he is showing toward his sister. If he gives the toy back, there is no need for discipline. If he refuses to give it back, discipline might be required. Making a distinction between correction and discipline is helpful. Children require correction all the time. And it's good to allow the emotional cost of their action to accrue to them. Quote, it is a valuable form of discipline for a child to be able to experience the disappointment or sadness that a poor decision on their part brings to someone else's life. You should actively seek out opportunities to expose your child to social, emotional, or personal consequences of poor decisions that they make, not to intentionally embarrass them, but rather to help them fully realize the consequences of failures, such as a lack of preparedness or not telling the truth. As discipline, Joe DeSena takes his kids' phones away and uses them as leverage. If you have a bad attitude, you lose your phone. And yeah, I guess I don't have a big problem with that as long as you're the one paying for the phone. Also, regarding discipline and rules, I have two other tips for you. Avoid immediate consequences and prioritize empathy. So don't respond immediately with emotion or anger when my kid does something naughty. And a tip for avoiding endless questioning. Our toddlers love to ask us over and over again if they can watch a show, eat candy, or do other activities. Our rule is that if they ask more than once for something, they lose that privilege. This rule means that they have to self-regulate and that truly no means no. Okay, I like that. And in the discipline department, my wife and I are planning on doing the nonviolent parenting thing. So we're both committed to not hitting, not spanking, no genital mutilation. Yeah, I've researched this one enough, and I think the nonviolent peaceful parenting is the way to go. Next important point, affirm behaviors, not outcomes. Quote, with our first son, Isaac, we would often affirm how smart he was, but we later learned that it is more important to affirm our children for the actions that lead us to thinking about how smart they are. So we started to affirm behaviors more than outcomes. This is important because as children grow older, they may not get the outcome they want, but if they practice specific behaviors, they will eventually achieve their goals. What gets rewarded gets conditioned. Our goal is to continue to reward and affirm the actions they take rather than the outcomes they get. Next topic is education. So let's talk about unschooling, which is a subset of homeschooling whereby parents empower children to learn not through coerced curriculum, but through self-directed play projects, activities, and outings. And it's also recommended that you send them to spy school. This sounds super cool. It's a program that teaches life skills and context of spy-related topics like situational awareness, code breaking, foreign languages, stealth movement, and different forms of written and signal communication. Spy school helps to emphasize that every situation is filled with choice and is important to make good choices with the information that you have at any given time. And I will try to find some spy schools. There's got to be a couple of those out there, and I'm really wondering if I could find one here in Europe where we live. Maybe I need to start the spy school. Although I lost my virginity to a spy, but I don't have, and I did meet a spy that one time. Yeah. Maybe I'm like well qualified to run a spy school in a decade or two here in this little corner of Europe. We shall see. Okay, next on the love and logic approach. Jessa Greenfield writes, "The idea behind this approach is that if there's a problem or decision, you present your kids with the pros and the cons. You educate them on basically everything around it, and then you allow them to make the decision on their own. Explaining our actions before we do them has proven to be incredibly useful throughout our parenting journey. It is amazing how even the smallest of children can comprehend what we are saying, especially when it is spoken with love. On the primacy of intentionality, one of the best things we can do as parents is have a clear goal in mind and work intentionally toward achieving that. We created a list of the most important skills, values, and abilities that we would like our kids to learn by a certain age. And I could see us doing that. My wife and I do goal outlining around January 1st every year. So we could add to that outlining what we want to teach our kid. On homeschooling, quote, homeschool gave us a lot more time together as a family than we would have had if we opted for a school outside of the home. For example, we usually got up for breakfast together and usually dressed for the day. Each of the kids had an individual schedule and chart of what to accomplish in each subject for the particular day. These charts included science, math, music, art, geography, history, grammar, literature, writing, editing, vocabulary, and other particular areas of interest. I made these charts weekly based on their progress and mastery of subjects. It was normal in our home to have each child in different grades, in different subjects, which I believe is one of the strengths of homeschooling. You can speed up when the kids have mastered a topic and slow down if they need more time. Choosing a good curriculum also really helped, and we preferred to pick and choose for each subject rather than use a full done-for-you curriculum from just one company or publisher. We were often able to finish the day's studies before other schools were out, and this allowed time for our kids to pursue their specific natural interests. In short, homeschooling gave us a lot of creative freedom, and my wife and I are leaning towards homeschooling. schooling. In fact, we've got a bit to learn about what the laws are like here in Bulgaria. It is not quite as homeschooling friendly as, say, America. We know we don't want to do public schools. If I'm really rich by then, perhaps we'll do private schools if we can afford it. But homeschooling or the unschooling, that seems like a real win-win. I think it'd be fun to be the kids' teacher for at least a couple of hours a week. And AI is going to make homeschooling really easy, I have a feeling. Yeah. I remember my mother trying to homeschool us about 3 decades ago and really struggling with it. But I bet you AI is going to make homeschooling really easy. In fact, I might do a search for some homeschooling AI apps that are out there and link them in this. On raising entrepreneurs. At age 16, our children create their own business and start to take accountability for their own futures. From that point forward, they pay for vacations, college, and their mission. Then, when they are 18, the business they created at 16 gets shut down and they give it all back to humanity. Going to serve for 2 years in humble circumstances and learn a second language. And Katie Wells adds, another noteworthy way that we teach our kids about learning from failure is through a non-negotiable verbal contract that states that they need to have a successful, profitable business for a year before they can get a car or a phone. Entrepreneurship, even on a small scale, teaches many of the core values that I want to impart to my kids in the hands-on way. Starting with managing their own business teaches them responsibility, attention to detail, and management of numbers. And I really like that idea where the business gets shut down at age 18 and they have to spend 2 years doing something humbling. Because over the years, I've known a couple of entrepreneurs who started as entrepreneurs in their teens and they experienced success. And then that success just kind of rolled on. And they ended up, in some cases that I can think of, really not having very good character as adults because all they had ever known was like success and maybe like a degree of glamour in the work world. Yeah, they had never had to clean bathrooms for minimum age like I had to. So yeah. I think there's really something to that, to making sure even if they end up successful as young entrepreneurs, to make sure that they get to experience some humbling work as well, because there's some value in that. Next, on the topic of training divergent thinking. Once you have a more open-ended range of possibilities, exploring terrain, problems, and decisions, you've entered the creative world of divergent thinking. You also move into divergent thinking as soon as you move away from conventional and orthodox approaches. I walked my 15-year-olds to school every day until high school. On 95% of these school days, during these walks, I brought up questions that helped encourage divergent thinking. Next, let them learn about failure. It's crucial to let kids fail at home and let them fail gently. If children have difficulty with losing, put them in situations that will help them develop positive coping skills. Enroll them in a chess club or find other contexts in which they will frequently win and lose. Role play what happens when they lose. And here's a cool factoid from Danny Vega, The trivium is derived from the ancient Latin tres, tria, and via, which is way, path, or method. It provides a threefold methodology for teaching the truth, involving grammar, logic, and rhetoric. The ancient trivium was also divided into three: knowledge, grammar, understanding, logic, and wisdom, that's rhetoric. In modern times, we can classify this as input, processing, and output. And that is going into my super memo, flashcards, which is a tool that I link to. This is a tool that kind of hacks the forgetting processes in the mind. Yeah, this is like a memory hack. This is a way that I remember a bunch of different little factoids from all the different books that I read. Next, start early with chores. If we could go back and do it again, we would have them do more domestic chores at an even earlier age. Start preparing and cooking their own meals and doing more chores around the house. Encourage them to make their own beds, clean their rooms, and do their own laundry. Not judge how well they do it, just focus on their efforts. Let them practice and help them create habits. Next big topic is parenting psychology. Carl Jung wisely warned that all children are affected by their parents' unfinished business, saying, "The greatest burden a child must bear is the unlived life of its parents." It follows logically, then, that as a parent, if you live a full life before your children, you are less likely to have this pathology of living vicariously through them. Oh boy, I hope Carl Jung is right about that, because my son will be well set up for success, because I lived a really full life before him. Next, every son must quote-unquote kill his father. This sounds harsh, but Rich has deliberately set it up this way and told his sons so. He gives them opportunity to beat him, whether in sports or business or anything else. He doesn't, of course, want them to literally kill him, but instead to surpass him in excellence and get to the point of independence where they no longer need him. And the father must pass the torch to the son. The author of Wild at Heart, Discovering the Secret of a Man's Soul, argued that every young man needs to be able to pinpoint the moment when his father passes the torch, so to speak. If that never happens, it leads to the birth of a false self, which could manifest as the tough guy, the womanizer, the workaholic, the wimp, etc. And this has got me questioning if my dad ever passed the torch to me, and I cannot think of anything there. And I'm not sure if I ended up as I didn't end up as a tough guy. I didn't really end up as a womanizer. I'm a bit of a workaholic, not a bad workaholic. And I'm not that wimpy either. So I'm not sure if I agree with that one. But yeah, passing the torch, that seems important. And there's a body language tip from Todd Kashdan, a lesson I have learned from my work as a clinical psychologist, is that kids will often talk more when you are side by side with them. Yeah, it's always easier to get people to open up when you're side by side with them. Switching topics to allowances. Yeah, to money. Quote, "We don't do allowance," since Jumpstart Coalition research shows that this is connected to lower levels of motivation and aversion to work. Our kids use the penny method, which involves earning pennies starting at 3 years old. These pennies can be earned by doing things around the house, like cleaning, pulling weeds, sweeping the garage, doing dishes, picking up toys, or engaging in random acts of kindness. Once the kids have collected 10 pennies, they can earn things like a small treat, a book, a show, or a toy from the store. One penny equals $1. Our three-year-old earned 32 pennies to get his first Nerf gun to play with his dad. He even had 4 pennies left over and gave them to his older sister to buy a craft at the store. And Chad Willardson describes a menu of opportunities, and that is a boring name. He writes, "We've never paid any of them even $1 of allowance, which is unusual. Instead, we created a menu of opportunities, which is a spreadsheet of work tasks and chores that they can choose from each week, with points assigned to each task based on the level of difficulty and time required to complete it. So I fully intend to bribe my kid to read books. When he's old enough, I think I will start him with the children's book series, Unexplainable Adventures, the first fictional character-based series of growth and development books geared specifically for children." Yeah, one of the gurus that contributed a chapter to Boundless Parenting has these fiction books that are kind of like personal growth fiction books, maybe kind of like my book Hourglass, but appropriate for children. That sounds really cool. Next, on the topic of building character, encourage their individuality, letting them be a little weird. Honestly, the people whom we tend to admire in high school, the people for whom life comes easily, the cool kids and athletes, often end up having relatively uninteresting lives. It's the weirdos, the innovators, and the creatives who end up having incredibly interesting careers and changing the world. Let them struggle, Katie Wells explains. One of the ways I can best nurture and create that is by following one simple rule. I don't do anything for them that they're capable of doing themselves. This means that by age 4 or 5, they're doing their own laundry, keeping their rooms clean, helping in the kitchen, and sometimes even cooking because they're capable of it. Give them the opportunity to struggle and learn. Jessica Leahy explains, "One aspect that I really screwed up was fostering learned helplessness in my kids when they were frustrated. As parents, we have a tendency to take over for our kids in these scenarios because we don't like to see them frustrated or doubting their own abilities. I intervened too early, too often, and did too much for my kids. In doing so, I stole a lot of learning opportunities from them." Scott Donnell asserts that a sense of a warm family team is the greatest predictor of kids' success. And in the building character department, Scott Donnell asserts that a sense of a warm family team is the greatest predictor of kids' success after they leave the house and encounter temptation, such as drugs, sex, etc. And I am going to contact him because I want a footnote for that one. I want to know what the evidence is for his assertion. As you can see, I got a haircut, a self-administered buzz cut, because as a brand new father, I need the lowest maintenance possible haircut right now. Next, let's talk about travel hacking parenting. Why travel with your kids? Quote, "When I look back at my own life, I realize that some of the hardest things in my life made the greatest impact on who I am today. While I wouldn't purposely make my children's lives difficult to develop their character, I don't want to protect my kids from the normal and neutral difficulties of life that serve as excellent teachers. This is one reason why we like traveling with the kids. Travel presents a unique set of difficulties and circumstances and also offers beautiful learning experiences." Next, find kid trading partners. We also would sometimes trade off kids with a neighbor since we didn't have grandparents around to watch them. When we wanted to go on our trips, we would leave our kids in the care of this family and vice versa. Sometimes it could get crazy when we were watching their five kids. That's a house of 10 kids in total for a week. But then they would help with our kids while we were on vacation. On apologizing. Whenever I make a mistake and kind of blow up on the job, I ensure that my kids know it's not because I hate my job as a parent. It's because I made a mistake that day. I let them know, hey, I love what I do. I love helping people. Sometimes I'm a human and I get annoyed and I get upset. But please don't think I don't love my job. I love what I do every day. It's just that occasionally stuff goes south and I don't respond the way I should. So I use it as a teaching moment. On admitting to errors. When we missed an opportunity to coach our children in the moment, we would always try to go back and tell them where we went wrong. There were certain times when we handled a situation inappropriately or lost our temper. And those were the times when we would sit the kids down and say, "Let me tell you why my response was wrong. We both think that this was something we did right as parents." On marriage. And here's an idea I really liked. Presenting a unified front. If we ever disagreed about aspects of parenting, we always tried to discuss them privately. Otherwise, the kids might try to divide and conquer us. Yes, kids can be very strategic in that way. We also avoided talking negatively about one another to our children. On disagreements. This means that Liver Queen lets me remain the head of the house. She doesn't challenge me in front of my boys. She walks with me after dinner, hand in hand, barefoot. During this time, we talk and course correct for the next dinner, if need be. Next, what is love? Here's Virgil Knight on the love languages, you've heard of those, and on apology languages. Quote, "The love languages can easily be used for manipulating people. If you learn to type somebody in the first few seconds after meeting them, you can basically morph into their same style of communication so that you're speaking their language. As a result, this skill can be used for effective persuasion or even manipulation. But it shouldn't be. Instead, it should be used as a means of learning to communicate effectively and strengthen existing relationships. It should manifest as an apology language. While many people have heard of the five love languages, comparatively few have heard of the five apology languages. First is in my primary relationships, close family, for which I have a love and apology language, Knight. You can do this as a family or just start as a couple. First, go online to 5apologylanguages.com and 5lovelanguages.com. Take the quick tests, each of which takes about 10 minutes to complete. Print out the results, exchange them with each other, and read each other's results out loud. And I will link to those websites. Those quizzes sound like a good self-exploration, self-knowledge exercise. Katie Wellis describes unconditional love. One thing I say to my kids every single day is, I love you unconditionally. There's nothing that you can ever do that will take away from that. And there's nothing you ever need to do to earn that. I think the fact of not having to earn it is key, because we don't often hear that. And I'm curious, listener, do you believe in unconditional love? I don't have my mind made up on this concept yet. My wife and I love each other very much, but we have always said that our love of at least each other is not unconditional. Yeah, it's kind of something that we kind of treat our love of each other as a earned performance kind of thing, which keeps us both motivated. Next, on slowing down, which is, I think, a thing that I am going to struggle with, that I'm going to have a lot of learning to do in this department. Joseph Anu and Amelia Roon write, slowing down has been our main ingredient for quality time with our son. As parents, we should be asking ourselves, where can I slow down and enjoy more quality time with my child? And here's a good hack for making them, the child, feel like a priority. The best thing a father can do is to surprise the kids by making time for them when they think you're very busy. This enables you to show them the real order of importance of things in your life. And this reminds me of something Orrin Claff wrote in one of his books. He has these great books about deal making and sales persuasion. I've reviewed a couple of them. And he talks about how he will, sometimes when he's got a big deal on the line and his family all knows that he has a big deal on the line, he'll instead go and take a day to go and do something important with his family, even in the midst of a big deal, just to let them know what really matters. And that's also probably a little bit of a hack for dealing with the other side of the deal when you're negotiating. It kind of shows that you're the one in the take it or leave it position. On health and biohacking, let's talk about EMFs versus kids. The problem is that children absorb far more of this EMF radiation than adults. This is not only because their body has a higher water content, which makes it more conductive to radiation, but also because they have thinner skulls, a growing brain, and rapidly dividing cells, making their neuromuscular system more susceptible to damage. And yeah, EMFs, that's kind of a big, scary topic. There is some disinformation in this area on the internet, but EMF is a threat to all of us in, well, in ways great and small. And so I'm going to link over to my deep dive book review of EMF'd by Dr. Mercola. And that is a super pragmatic book review. Yeah, that article is going to give you a lot of actionable takeaways. Next, babies need boobies. Bottle-fed babies have a higher incidence of oral facial disorders, need for braces, facial distortion, malocclusion, and other types of chronic orthopedic issues compared to breastfed children. they also have a higher incidence of degeneration in the temporomandibular joint later in life. Baby formulas are also loaded with soy, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, rodenticides, and glyphosate. Ew! Things that are completely toxic to their small bodies and wipe out their microbiome. What about dry milkers? Well, some of Paul Check's research has shown that goat's milk is the best substitute for babies. And drawing to my conclusion on this book review, Boundless Parenting gets 4 stars from me. Same rating that I gave Boundless. I think Ben may have read my criticisms of his biohacking magnus opus, because this one doesn't begin so braggadociously, nor does it contain product pitches on nearly every page. Bravo, Ben. Why doesn't it get 5 stars from me? Well, it seems more aimed at parents in the midst of their parenting journey, not at the beginning of it, like us here. I was hoping for Ben's top 10 biohacks for brand new babies and did not get it in this book. In fact, I expected a Ben Greenfield book would really bring the goods in the biohacking department, and this one is a bit light on the topic. Frankly, I'm still looking for a comprehensive guide to optimizing my wife. I think that's a form of wife hacking would be the phrase for that. I'm still looking for a comprehensive guide to optimizing her bountiful boobies for maximum milk production. So maybe you can direct me. And as I'm at the very beginning of this journey, I am open to your recommendations of more great books and resources on this topic. I'm Jonathan Roseland with Limitless Mindset, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.
I read a book called Boundless Parenting. It said, raise your kid like a Spartan king. Cold plunges, no screens, 12 languages before 3. Meanwhile, I forgot where I put my own car keys. We're boundless, but borderline unhinged. Tracking bowel movements like we're data binge. We've had sleep and play, but not tantrum zen. Can I microdose patience and try this again? I gave my kid adaptogens instead of dessert. Now she won't nap unless she's wearing a red light shirt. She's keto, paleo, and raw milk fed, but cries every time I won't let her eat bread. They say don't outsource parenting to an iPad, but how else do I meditate while keeping them from going mad? Juice cleanses, home births, and no EMF. My Wi-Fi's off, but I'm still totally stressed. We're boundless, but borderline unhinged. Tracking bowel movements like we're data binge. We've had sleep and play, but not tantrum zen. Can I microdose patience and try this again? They say, don't outsource parenting to an iPad. But how else do I meditate while keeping them from going mad? Juice cleanses, home births, and no EMF. My Wi-Fi's off, but I'm still totally stressed. We're boundless, but borderline unhinged. Tracking bowel movements like we're data binged. We've had sleep and play, but not tantrum zen. Can I microdose patience and try this again?
Greenfield's kid plays the violin shirtless. One mind just did someone at church service. I tried grounding her with copper-soled shoes. She just licked a rock and screamed, I am news. We're boundless, but borderline unhinged. Tracking bowel movements like we're data binge. We've had sleep and play, but not tantrums zen. Can I microdose patience and try this again? So here's to the parents, biohacking with pride. We're jacked on nootropics, but dying inside. I love my kids, but let's make it clear. I'm boundless too, boundlessly weird. Whether you're a dangerously optimized dad or a mitochondrially marvelous mom, edify yourself at limitlessmindset.com.